You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Rod Howe. Good morning, Rod. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Eric, for having me.
So the way we start the show is just with this huge question as a way to get us into each other's lives. Who are you? You know, what are some qualities or stories or labels that would help us to start the conversation?
Sure, and it's hard to unpack a life because it tends to be many things being pieced together.
I'll just mention
a few things, and
yeah,
I know that
sure.
we'll touch base on others as we go throughout the interview. I grew up in Lansing, New York, and was very fortunate to be embedded in two families. So both my maternal and my paternal families are both from this area, have long histories in this area. So my life was one of seeing grandparents regularly, aunts, cousins.
How many generations back?
Well, on the house side of the family, there's still my brother still owns land that's been in the family since 1820, right here in Groton.
Wow.
On Dryden. So generations, and the nobles go back in this general area for generations as well.
Wow.
And it was a very different experience. I had many friends whose parents were college professors and came here specifically for Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, it was such a different experience than what they were had. They were always like, you're getting together with family again?
Yeah, they do that like three times a year at most.
Correct. So sure. I feel very blessed that those first 18 years of my life were being very grounded in the nobles and the Howe families.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you know, there's college, there's going on and figuring out what you're going to do with a career. There's decisions about family. Where are you going to live? And so I did choose to come back to this area to raise a family.
That's really, really neat. I resonate for two reasons with your story. Five generations of my ancestors are buried within 6 miles of each other, north of Kansas City, about 70 miles. In Missouri, northwest corner of Missouri. So I know a little bit about what that's like. And I also have a love for history, which I think is where your life is now in terms of your work.
Correct.
You brought some music with you. And you brought Janice Ian for starters. Do you want to say something about that before we play it or after?
After.
Okay, here we go. And this one I remember very much from my teenage years.
I learned the truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens, and high school girls with clear skin smiles, who married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth, were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, and murmured fake obscenities. It isn't all it seems at 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could pronounce, said, pity please the ones who serve, they only get what they deserve. Rich Remation hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of company and haven for the elderly. Remember those who win the game, they lose the love they sought to gain.
was Janice Ian at 17, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Rod Howe. So, Rod, you said you'd comment on that song after we listened to it, so...
Sure. So it resonated with me because even though I grew up in this very close family, there was a certain aloneness and privacy that I had to experience. I'm gay, and it took me years to figure out what that mean in terms of the life that I was living with my family. We're churchgoers. We went to the United Methodist Church. So it was there was religious teachings that I was told were at odds with what I was experiencing. So the song afterwards, you know, much of what I was dealing with was before the song actually came out. This would have been in the 70s, early 70s, that I was a teenager and experiencing these things. So that song really, I think, resonates with anyone who feels that they don't quite hit the chords that others are experiencing and have to do some internal reflecting and thinking. So it really, when the song came out, it really resonated with what I experienced for a few years.
Yep. Yep. Yes. Whether it's gay or not being the body, the feminine body. You
right.
Want
so
as a
many
woman,
differences.
So own, many differences. Right. It's a haunting song with its truth.
And so even just now listening to it, it really is a beautiful song. And ideally, one comes out stronger as a result of having deal with whatever the differences that you might feel from mainstream society. And I think that we're at a point now in society, there's pockets, at least, where I think... we celebrate and want to acknowledge that there's this common humanity, but the richness is because we all bring different things and different perspectives and experiences to that. But I recognize that there's pockets of society where that feels safe and celebrated.
Right. Or safer.
Correct.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. This is you're raising a powerful image for me. I grew up in a congregation where there was a woman who was elected mayor of King City in 1930. She had been the postmistress for 10 years before that or so, from 1915 to 25 or so. She lived her whole life with a woman. She was a member of a congregation where women couldn't be deacons or elders, but she said, "They'll never meet without me." And so she went, and from the time she was, you know, in her 30s, she met with them until she died in her, she went into a nursing home and couldn't go to the meetings in her 90s. And I knew her when she was already, you know, I was aware of her when she was already like 70 years old because, you know, I was born later in her life and I was maybe 10 at the time. But she helped to make sure that I got to church camp as a poor kid, and whose father had died when he was 7. So that was a piece. And there was another man, there was a man in the congregation who was a superintendent of schools in a neighboring district. And he lived his whole adult life with another man who was a farmer. And he being a superintendent of schools was believed to be a person of some kind of a judgment and ability to work with people. So he was an elder in the congregation, and the man that he lived with was a deacon who did the service stuff, and as a farmer that fit his personalities. But I grew up with these people who were with same gender sex people, but they came of age in the 1910s and 20s, and they were incorporated into the life of the community. And there was hatred towards gays and lesbians that was becoming evident when my older siblings came of age in the 50s and 60s, and it was incredibly damaging. But still, here I was with these role models who were totally, they didn't talk out there, but they were out there.
Right. And certainly I realized in my own life that there were role models, but I didn't know they were role models until later on.
Yeah.
Because they were leading their quiet lives and choosing, well, it was just a different context. Right. You know, coming that 70s really started, late 60s, early 70s started the process.
Stonewall,
so one, I think, started to think about it in very different ways than perhaps the generation before me. Mm-hmm. And I never wanted, I mean, perhaps now some of my thoughts are things that I've just come to think about, but I never wanted it to be the way I was defined.
Yes.
That somewhere I read that it's, and this can be true of so many things in one's life, it was like having a drop of iodine dropped in your body. So it certainly infused how you thought about the world, but it wasn't the only thing that was defining you.
Yes.
So it, you know, and I like that. I mean, I think that it's hard for me to think about how I view the life differently if I wasn't gay, but it's, I have lots of other things that can define me.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the thing that I do think that it, part of the journey of my life, because it really took me some time to accept this, and it took a lot of energy. And so I was going to be an architect. I mean, I was going to be several things. So that's part of my life. It's this confluence of architecture, going to be a minister, going to do social work, going to study history, involved in community and economic development. And I have now find they all weave together very beautifully. But when I started going to college, I was going to be an architect. Mm-hmm. And so this was my freshman year. And that's where that's the year that it really took me a lot of energy to sort of figure this out. And it was exhausting.
Yep.
And I, in my sophomore year, I ended up dropping out of school temporarily just because, you know, if one has one, I think one should have one major regret in life. That's my one. I still want to be an architect, so I wish I hadn't dropped out. But I now think about it as just, I was doing other work that
sure.
was pushing other things to the side.
Sure. But is it a regret that you would, that you haven't, your life has been less, or that you would rather add that piece to the life that you've had?
Well, then I have certainly found ways to incorporate the love of buildings and architecture into my life. So it's really not, you know, I'm somewhat jokingly say a major, but it really was a defining point in my life.
Mm-hmm,
and
sure.
I, you know, I didn't tell my parents I was dropping out of school. I got used to having so many internal discussions. I guess the regret is that, I mean, it wasn't just the work of figuring out who I was. I had wanted to be an architect since I was quite young and realized, I think, when I was looking around at peers who were working with me in the studio, maybe I wasn't going to be the greatest architect that ever lived, but I never gave anyone the chance to say one can still enjoy a profession even if you're not going to be world renowned.
Right.
It just wasn't an option. I wish I had let a professor say, counsel me a little bit, because I didn't tell anyone. I just totally dropped out.
Right. Archie Ammons had a poem called that goes like this: the burdens of the world on my back lighten the world not a whit, while removing them reduces greatly my specific gravity.
Well said.
And that, you know, when you carry the burdens by yourself, there is no way. You know, it's totally isolating.
And I think that, you know, now I hope that I've learned at least that lesson. And if I know someone else is, you know, I feel that I'm a very perceptive person and can read people pretty well.
Sure.
So I hope that I open up some doors if I feel somebody's struggling, and just privately with something, to at least offer a chance to talk or unburden something
sure.
that might be that they might be carrying with them.
Yep. Well said. So how did you... What happened on the when you dropped out? What happened? How did you begin? I mean, I have my own dropout story. I came to Cornell and I was named a college scholar. My first semester did really well, but I had really bad study skills, and I knew to take it on really carefully. So I did well, and then I got into mass courses and I failed. And I left without telling anybody except for one advisor. But it was a very restorative time for me. What happened?
So, I ran away to Texas for a little bit because I had a brother who was in the Air Force and was on an Air Force base there. Mm-hmm. But it didn't take me long to figure out the next step. And the only other career I had thought about was being a minister. So I had been in communication with the minister that I had had as a high school and told him that I was thinking of going on to be a minister. Turns out he had gone to a very small liberal arts college in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, which is known as sort of a pre-seminary for folks who were thinking of going on. Mm-hmm. So I went to Lycoming College in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, a very small school, knowing that I was probably going to go on. And I wasn't sure where at that point, but I did go on to Boston University, to the School of Theology at Boston University. That was another hope moment, though, as I was studying theology. And by the way, I studied sociology and anthropology for my bachelor's at this very small school in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Yeah. So then I came back to Ithaca for a little while and worked in social work. I worked with what we then called group homes and was a live-in counselor.
Which one of them?
Primarily on Geneva Street. There was one on Geneva Street. Yeah, yeah. But I also did, at times, helped out at State Street. There was one on State Street. Yeah. And so I still have wonderful memories whenever I go by either of those houses. Mm-hmm. And I still see folks in the community that I lived with during that time.
Sure,
so it's very sweet. You know, but it was also interesting because I thought, oh my, a gay person doing social work, how stereotype, you know, I just didn't want to be defined by, because I knew a lot of folks doing social work who also happened to be gay.
Right.
And so I kind of brided by that. I didn't want to be defined by that. So I knew that I was going to go on and do some other things. So I did work as a social worker here in Ithaca for a couple of years. I actually had my educational path is complicated.
I spent
one semester as a grad student at Cornell University in city and regional planning.
Uh-huh.
It was sort of that architecture interest again, but right. I had a bachelor's. I was here and was trying to think how I can advance my degree. So I loved that semester in city and regional planning, but again, was impulsive and was ready for something else, so dropped out of Cornell. And within the next month, I was a student at Boston University School of Theology, working on a master's degree in theology. But that's a Methodist-based school.
Yep.
So
Martin Luther King Jr. did his PhD there.
Exactly. There's so much history associated with that school, and Boston, of course, is so rich in history. I ended up staying in Boston for quite a long time. But during working on that, and I was one of those that I always had to have a full-time job and go to school part-time just to make it all work. But I, you know, the Methodist, for the most part, still will not ordain openly gay and lesbian folks.
Right.
So this was, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, I decided maybe I wasn't going to go for a master's of to be ordained. I went instead for a master's of theological studies because I didn't want to play
again. So it's the difference between an MDiv and
MTS. So I made that decision at that point, which, you know, was another sort of marker in what paths were going to be open to me.
Yep.
I ended up staying on working at BU. I had several different positions at Boston University and decided to go for a PhD. Ended up getting a PhD in American history. It was really American studies. So that was a rich experience to do that. And stayed in Boston a bit beyond that and continued working. But so that's, I think that shows all the different educational components. I think we've covered all those different pieces. But it did set the stage for much of the rest of my life.
Right. And it also, I mean, there are two things that come out. One is you don't want to be defined by any one feature. And there's kind of almost a don't tread on me quality to that in terms of the way I hear it. And it may just be the way you're telling the story this morning, because that can be that way. And the other piece is having to really care for yourself so that you're working full time and doing school at the same time, and that sense of a measure of responsibility that is both highly honorable, but is it just too much?
But there were plenty. I'm a walker.
Yeah.
And there's no better city for walking than Boston. Yeah. There are. Paris is wonderful too, but Boston. So I walked a lot, and I'm a people watcher. I absorbed the city. I ended up teaching part time, and my favorite courses was to teach the history of Boston. And be able to get the students out and experience the city. So I have very fond memories of teaching the history of Boston course because it just fits so well with my ability to get out and fully experience that place. Mm-hmm. And again, that's one of sort of my key themes is I feel people should, wherever they happen to be, really get to know the place they're in for whatever period of time, including getting to know some of the history, but just experiencing it from multiple perspectives. That adds to me, it really adds to a rich and full life.
Right. And it's not a one-dimensional place anymore.
Right.
It can't be. Let's cut to music. What would you like to play? What would you like to play next?
Oh, let's do Thich Nhat Hanh.
Okie doke.
May the sound of this bell penetrate deep into the cosmos. Even in the darkest spots, living beings are able to hear it clearly, so that all suffering in them cease, understanding come to their heart, and they transcend the path of sorrow and death.
WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Rod Howe. Thich Nhat Hanh, that's a beautiful, beautiful piece.
So, you know, one's life is not linear, so, but this, I told you to play this one next, because I now define myself as a Buddhist Unitarian Quaker who happened to be raised a Methodist. And I actually was introduced to Thich Nhat Hanh a bit later in my life, but now he resonates with me. I love many of the writings that he has done. I had a chance to see him in New York City one time. How I now think about that is it was a way to start piecing together the different ways I thought about spirituality, that it didn't have to be, okay, I didn't have to be a Methodist or I didn't have to be a Buddhist pure, you know. So I fully believe that we figure it out and should feel free to draw from a number of traditions, which is obviously what the Unitarian Universalist feels. So that's one reason that's important to me.
Right. And a friend of mine was ordained by Thich Nhat Hanh, but the requirement of the ordination was that she make peace with her religion, the one that she came from, and she's active. I'm an active member in that congregation locally as well. And so it's a very powerful commitment he has to the integrity of one's journey, not forgetting the past, but not being completely tied up in it.
And that's, because I always add that element, who was raised a Methodist, because I'm amazed there's still phrases from, you know, what I would say growing up at church that still resonate with me and carry a lot of weight. So I love that that's very much in the mix. My two children are from Cambodia. So they were being raised as Buddhist in that country. So that's another reason that Thich Nhat Hanh speaks to me in that piece.
And maybe perhaps a different tradition in Buddhism or not, but you had said that you came back here to raise your family.
Mm-hmm.
And your family is children that you've adopted from mm-hmm. Cambodia. Tell me about that decision. How did that come into being?
Sure.
Yeah.
I was going to be a father.
Okay.
Even when I knew I was gay, I always knew that I was going to be a father. And so another sort of important turning point in my life is, very specifically one night in Boston. And I had already been making plans to move back to this area. I had already started thinking about how I was going to adopt children, but I wanted to raise them here. And I met my partner, Mark, 30 years ago. And I remember the conversation where I said, I'm going to have children. And I'm going to move back to a place called Ithaca, New York. That meant nothing to him. Ithaca, New York meant nothing to him.
And this was 30 years ago.
This was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And he told me that he was HIV positive. So I thought I was starting a relationship with someone who would be dead within a year.
And in 1986, that was not an unreasonable thought.
Right. Yeah. So saner people probably would have just parted ways. Instead, it was nice to meet you, but we didn't. And here we are 30 years later, children, grandchildren. We did move back to this mm-hmm. area. He absolutely loves Ithaca. So that was a really important. And we were going to originally do children through the Department of Social Services in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
But just as we were starting the process, there was a very public case where Governor Dukakis, because of some flack, took two boys away from two gay men.
Mm.
And so it started to become a policy that children would not be placed with openly gay folks. So I remember that we were part of marches in front of the governor's mansion, that type of thing. So our social worker suggested that we think about another path.
Right.
And she's the one who suggested we consider international adoption. So that's how we ended up focusing on Cambodia, because it was one of the countries that was, well, of course, we had to do this. I adopted our first son as basically a single man.
Yeah.
The social worker was willing to kind of help us play that game, if you will.
Sure.
To make it happen. We also felt a bit of a timeline because we weren't sure what was really going to happen with Mark, so we wanted to move forward quickly. So we weren't together very long before we started this whole process.
A
child was identified. Tien was his name. We still have a picture of him from Vietnam. And it just kept sort of not happening. And they would say every month, the next month it will happen. So we, in that meantime, had moved back here, in part because my father had been quite ill, and the goal was to move back here so I would still have some time for him. He actually ended up dying before we moved back here, but we started that motion.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
Tien never joined us. We never really know what the story was, but they said, how about considering another child in the meantime while we're still waiting for Tien to come and join mm-hmm. you? So they said that there could be a child from Cambodia. So we ended up with our first child about a year and a half after we had moved back here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you got the second child.
Yes, although there's quite a few years
between.
In a pinch,
okay,
you know.
Okay.
So both children have taught me so much mm-hmm. about life. And our first son came to us at the age of 5. By the way, it's a very interesting experience when you meet your son. So at that point, we didn't go to the country. He
right.
was brought here. And he was escorted here by different volunteers on each leg of the journey. So I still
wow.
really can't even imagine what this 5-year-old was thinking as he took this enormous trip halfway around the world.
And this was in
1991.
91, yeah.
And had these two men pick him up at the Syracuse airport. And that's when our life started as a family. Wow. So he was very malnourished. The first picture we saw of him, he really looked like a not much more than a little bit of flesh around some bones sitting on somebody's lap. So he was very malnourished. He had been sexually abused, apparently, because he had to be treated for syphilis. He had high levels of lead in his bloodstream, so had to be treated for that. Who knows what his family background was, because he was dropped off at the orphanage basically the day he was born, and spent 5 years in an orphanage that they did the best, but we know that there was limited food, limited resources. The children there didn't even really learn Khmer. They sort of learned how to speak to one another, but Cambodian folks here couldn't understand what he was saying
right. When
he came here, because there was a Cambodian small population here. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he had a lot of strikes against him, and which means he's had a challenging life. And so we were cautious before we chose to have another child enter our life. So it took some time.
Wow. How has parenting changed you?
Oh my gosh, you just give it your everything, and I can't even, I mean, again, I knew I was going to be a parent, but one doesn't know
what it's going to be.
Especially if there's some things that enter the picture that you weren't expecting. But, you know, you're a parent, so each day you are dealing with whatever this wonderful thing that happened to you brought mm-hmm. to you. I don't even know how to describe how it changed me, because it's so deep, and it's still changing me. I mean, our youngest will be graduating from high school this June, and daily he still sort of is educating me and making me think about new things.
Wow.
And with the addition of grandchildren, that's been wonderful as well.
Cool. Cool.
So going back to that 30 years ago, mm-hmm, sure. We feel blessed and full of gratitude that here we are 30 years later. Mark is very healthy. There were times that he wasn't, but he was one of the very lucky people. Mm-hmm. And so you just can't help but feel full of gratitude for this 30 years later.
Yep. No, you are saying so much more even than I think many listeners can know, because you've lived a narrative that we have not fully appreciated or fully voiced. And I'm grateful for your willingness to talk with us.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, it took a while before we were sharing Mark's health status with a lot of folks. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But when it got to the point where it was pretty clear, things were going to, I mean, be okay. Mm-hmm. For lots of reasons, we did start
and
to
And the scare factor began to come
Correct.
Down about 10
right.
or 15 years
right.
ago.
Right, right. When protease inhibitors came on, then they came on just at the right time for him.
Yeah, I started I started visiting people with HIV AIDS in 1984 at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York, when the nurses wouldn't even go in except when they were required every 2 hours on rounds. It was the chaplains who went in and sat and talked with people who were understandably enraged at God, enraged at their health, enraged at everybody around them.
So we just feel very grateful.
Yeah. No, I understand. Yeah. How have you had to change in ways that you would not have predicted?
Well, the one always hopes that they would change more than they have. So when I knew this question,
I don't think everybody hopes that
coming. So, you know, I want to be a wise person. Mm-hmm. I know that one needs to relax at times, to let life just, you know, you can't control what happens, you know. So I know all these things intellectually, but I keep waiting for it to really play out and how it. So I feel that I don't, you know, if I want still to change, so right. that I feel that, wait, it's just going to happen. So, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh's messages are always sort of important to be reminded of, and realizing that there's so little one can really control about life, and just to not sweat the big stuff or little stuff sometimes. So, but I do think that I am, I'd like to think I'm certainly more grounded. You've just heard me talk about all these sort of jumping around to different things that I was studying in college. So I think that it's all now grounded me. I feel that I think I come across as a very serene person on the outside, but I think I try to hide the jumble sometimes of that happens in the intensity at times that happens on the inside.
Do you remember the song Classical Gas? It was the first instrumental piece of music to be a pop song number one back in the mid-60s, and it has a really driving sense of multiple melodies playing in and out of each other. I used to present with a calm outside, but inside my mind and everything was just that. That was the song that was, and people wouldn't believe it. And you're telling me the same sort of thing. I'm wondering, were you not grounded, or were you just moving fast when you were young?
Maybe, moving fast because I was trying to figure out all these pieces that I wanted to play out in my life.
Yeah.
So I think it took some time. I think it is like, it's almost like jazz. So maybe that's another analogy to the music reference you just had, that jazz can be a little frenetic at times, but then at times a jazz piece can just really be more calming. So, you know, I like jazz and blues. So, you know, maybe that's a nice analogy, thinking about my life as jazz-like at times, more noisy, and other times a little bit. And I'd like to think I'm entering a more soothing jazz period.
Right. And what is it about life now that you need the soothing? That you didn't either need it or didn't seek it in the past?
Oh, I think I've always sought it. So I think it's just part of my phase of life now.
So you can accept it now.
Yeah. And really knowing how strongly I feel about this place that we're in, Ithaca and Tompkins County. I kid that I want my epitaph to read Placemaker. I really feel strongly about one being connected to their place, wherever they happen to be, and exploring it from different angles. And Ithaca and Tompkins County are so rich in terms of the ways to think about this place. I often use place as an acronym, people, land, architecture, culture, and enterprise. So it's an integrative piece for me. It allows me to think about all those things I studied and had some interest in, and I can play them out through this focus on place and being a placemaker and helping others be placemakers. So I often talk about placemaking that can take many different forms. We can all be placemakers from our own passions and interest.
Yep. And oftentimes, well, we can be placemakers. Much of the time, we don't realize the place we're in. We are in arguably the most religiously diverse county, one of the most religiously diverse counties in the U.S., certainly in upstate New York, in terms of the mixture of folk here. But we don't realize that. We don't realize that we have the highest rate of gay and lesbian-headed households outside of the New York County, which is Manhattan in the city. There's lots of pieces that we don't necessarily embrace, that we are have the highest income mutation rate of any county, any place outside of New York City. We don't, you know, it's funny.
And as you know, we have many folks who will only be here 4 years, less than sometimes. So it's it really, to me, makes it even more intriguing.
Yeah.
And I think history, knowing if again, I really want everyone, wherever they are, to know some aspect of history. So for the folks who are here, so we even encourage college students, while you're here, get to know some aspect of the local history, because that can be a connective piece with other folks in the community. It can be a bit of a grounding piece. It can be a connective piece. But there's still so much work that we want to make sure that people have opportunities to share their narratives, share their journeys, which sometimes is grounded in this place. But because we're such a community that has people weaving in and out, that's okay. I mean, that adds to the richness.
I'm going to ask this question in a kind of blunt way. What difference does history make?
So I have talked about, I give this example of two people who live in Tompkins County. Mm-hmm. Both folks thoroughly enjoy Tompkins County. It can be a great place to live.
Sure.
One has chosen to get to know some aspect of the history of the place, and the other person hasn't. And again, there's so many doors into getting, I mean, it can be, so I happen to have a love of barns. So you can get to know the history of this place through studying barns. For other people, it might be a particular ethnic group. Mm-hmm. What was their experience? So there's so many doors. I think that the person who chooses to get to know some aspect of the history of the place, their life is richer. That there's more ability for them to connect with others on a different level because they've gone one extra step.
Right.
So to me, and especially a place, you know, since I grew up here, I'm old enough now that I can drive around and know that, oh, there used to be a barn there that if somebody
Nobody
moved
knows.
Here 5 years ago, they would never know that. And so then it makes me think about the people who lived there. And so it saddens me if there's not some interest and awareness to think about the land that we traverse and what stories are underneath that land or that land hold.
Right. You used two words earlier. One was perspective and the other one was wisdom. And I think that they combine with history to give the kind of grounding, because you can't be wise unless you have a sense of resilience that comes from multiple perspectives that you've been able to take, and to know that the families aren't here, that in some cases the loss of substandard housing is not a bad thing, because it was not a safe place for the people who lived in it anyway, and now we hope that their descendants have been able to figure it out.
Right. The house I lived in the first 5 years of my life was torn down a few years ago. And that was really sad to me. And I mean, it was actually
a huge
farm with several outbuildings. They're all gone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so now people driving by there, if they're newer to the area, wouldn't know of this incredible set of outbuildings that was there. And a friend of mine, actually, she didn't know I had lived in that house. She started writing a story about imagining who used to live in that house. And when I told her, I used to live in that house, it just popped for her. It's like,
wow.
And that's what we're hoping that people experience through, you know, and part of it is just, you know, so of course I work at the History Center now.
Sure.
I'm the executive director of the History Center in Tompkins County. And one of the goals is to be a place where people come and share their journeys and stories with one another, because if you take time to do that, it just starts to open up doors and you connect in new and different ways.
Mm-hmm. Should we cut to music?
Sure.
Do you want to say something about Seasons of Love now from Rent, or do you want afterwards, or just let it be its own?
I'll just say a couple things afterwards.
How about love? How about
WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is Rod Howe, and that was Seasons of Love from Rent. So, Rod, tell me about that song.
It's such a beautiful song, and it just reminds us that there are seconds and minutes to life, and that one never knows what's going to come next. So certainly, given the age I'm in, I've experienced loss in my life. I've have two siblings who have died. Grandparents, of course, and a father, and aunts and uncles. And so it just reminds me that not to take life for granted. I mean, I know it's cliche to say that.
What does it mean to not take it for granted?
It gets back to really, one of the things that I still need to learn is to get a better balance on life, but it's making sure that you take time out to refresh yourselves, to renew yourself, mm-hmm. to be present to mm-hmm. others in your life. I know that I'm always I'm so busy to my family and friends, and I hate that that's sort of a mantra that I sometimes have. So songs like that just are there to try to remind me, or do remind me, I just have to play it out, to as we connect, to really connect and to be present to one mm-hmm. another, and to know that there's going to be, life is full of the sweet and the sorrowful at times. Mm-hmm. And it's part of those seasons of one's life, and that hopefully folks connect with one another. Hopefully everyone has someone that they feel strongly about, more than one person that they love, whether it's children, mm-hmm. parents, mm-hmm. spouses. It's just a beautiful song.
It is. And also I'm going to hazard something that may be off base, but I don't have a very good sense of balance when I stand still, but if I move, my balance is great. Mm-hmm. And balance is what we have from one stride to the next, from one extreme to the next. And my sense is that there's a kindness that you could experience by taking that metaphor more mm-hmm. than the more fixed balance mm-hmm. metaphor. And I would like you to take it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. 'Cause, and that's, I gave up a long time ago on being one of those who can sit and meditate.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Walking meditation mm-hmm. is more my style.
Yep.
That fits, I think, with what you're offering.
Yeah, yeah. And Thich Nhat Hanh has in his book on anger, has a deep relaxation meditation that I used to use with children, late at elementary school up through high school, and would talk them through the deep relaxation mm-hmm. meditation. Almost 3/4 of them would go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered in that was that many of them don't know how to relax, and they have trouble sleeping at night, which is not what we think about with children, but mm-hmm. they have as much problem with sleeping as adults. So it was a powerful moment mm-hmm. for me to learn about how to share.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do on a daily basis? This is the question I like to end the show mm-hmm. with. What do you do to restore yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically, on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis? And how do you know you need to do it?
Well, I like to walk. When the weather's better, I like to bike. I love to read. I have this I have this alter ego that I call Pete. And there's a part of me that feels I'm most meant to be a monk. So he's Pete the monk.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so I have this whole essay about what's an ideal life, ideal day like in Pete the monk's
life. The monk's life, yes.
And so it's baking, it's reading, it's walking, it's gardening, it's visiting friends, it's doing something out in the community. So it's all the things that ideally I would want to incorporate, if not daily, at least in a weekly.
Mm-hmm.
So I often step back and say, how far am I from that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little ways, just because, you know, in one day you can't do all those wonderful things, or at least I can't right now. So, but I incorporate a fair amount. The thing that I do like to write, I find that I'm not spending time writing now. I tend to write essays about connections to land, place, architecture,
sure,
people, community. So I'm hoping to get back soon to a place where I'm doing, even if it's just a small amount of time every day for writing, because I think that helps to sort of center me and balance me as well.
Right. So the writing confirms what you is more nebulous otherwise.
Correct. Okay. It's out there and it's sort of thoughts, but I like the creative process too, of putting words on paper that takes a concept you're dealing with and makes it real.
What do you or Mark or your kids see in you when you begin to kind of come unglued and you need to do an attitude adjustment, or you need to kind of find the balance again?
My 18-year-old is pretty good about saying, you need to relax, Dad. So it's just, I mean, I don't really get angry.
So he's good about saying it and you can actually hear it.
Oh yeah, I can hear it. I don't know that I act on it. So, you know, they'll just send me, they'll sort of reflect back that it seems like you're under some stress, that you need to do something. But I kind of know it too. I know myself pretty well. So I can find those moments when I need to maybe just take a walk.
What do you notice when you know it? I mean, the reason I'm pressing this is these are things we don't think about and we don't talk about in public, but they're part of how we are human.
Well, it's for me, sometimes it feels like your mind gets jammed because there's too many things you're trying to sort through at once.
So it's a traffic jam.
Yeah. And so it's amazing to me what just getting up and taking a 10-minute walk will do.
Mm-hmm.
It just getting out and walking for me can do it pretty quickly. I mean, I understand that's not restorative enough, that you need to spend, that it can't just be every once in a while you take a 10-minute walk and that's going to do it for you, but that helps.
But it's a skill and you know you need to do it and you do it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. When did you come aware in your life? I mean, you describe yourself as one who took responsibility for yourself by yourself. When did you learn that you could share the responsibility for yourself with somebody else?
It was probably really through parenting and some of the things that we experienced with our first son. So, I mean, even that, Mark and I probably tried to do too much on our own, but I think through parenting, but also just through experiencing deaths of close ones, that you start to realize it's much easier to carry burdens when they're shared.
Right. And I think a lot of us, at least me, initially you take care of yourself, and I was part of that kind of tradition. And then you add a person, but it's just like the self slightly bigger, and then that has to be broken.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in effect, what you've described, until you can let others in.
Correct.
Rod, it's been really good to get to know you.
Thank you for having me on the show, Eric.
And is there anything else that you'd like to share before we call it a day? Anything about this Stand By Me particularly?
This gets back to what we were just talking about, in fact, that sometimes you might need to invite people to stand by you, or you may need to take a proactive step to stand by someone that you know is struggling. This is a song that my sister chose to have sung at her funeral. We actually, it was very, so
you
I got to spend.
You seem much too young to have two siblings who
have
died.
Yeah, it's very sad.
Yeah.
I got to spend a week with my sister, mm-hmm. the week right before she died. And a couple nights before we had to leave, she wanted the song to play. And we all just, she was dealing with cancer. We all gathered around her and stood her up. And so that sort of happened spontaneously at her funeral as well. One of her children went up and her ashes were on the altar. And then many of us just went up and circled the altar when the song was playing Stand By Me. So it's I think, a reminder for all of us that we need to stand with each other at times.
Cool. Cool. And that we will close on. Thank you.
Thank you.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me, stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear. Just as long as you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand now, stand by me, stand by me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.